Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, President Trump's relationship with the media. Perhaps nobody embodies it more than CNN's Jim Acosta.
There's a lot of Department of Homeland Security data out there that shows border crossings.
He's made a name for himself the past few years with his verbal sparring with the president.
Do you really believe that?
What do you? Well,
take a look at our federal prisons.
I believe in facts and statistics.
Okay,
and data,
any more? Quick, let's go.
Let me just ask you this: what do you say to your critics?
While some have applauded Acosta's tenacity, Trump supporters accuse him of grandstanding. The president himself has lashed out, calling Acosta the enemy of the people. It's a term President Trump has used to describe the media in general at least 30 times since taking office. It's also the title of Jim Acosta's new book, Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. Jim Acosta, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Diane. Great to be here.
Take us back to January 2017, just after the news broke about the Steele dossier. This particular news conference sort of set the stage for Trump's relationship with the media.
It really did. CNN broke a story that day. My colleagues at CNN broke this story that said that the U.S. intelligence community had gone to the president-elect and said, Mr. President-elect, the Russians may have compromising information on you, and this may affect your presidency, and you need to know about this. He went into that press conference on January 11, 2017, along with the vice president-elect and the incoming press secretary, Sean Spicer, and proceeded to go off on us for a good period of time, referring to this story as fake news and so on.
It's a disgrace what took place. It's a disgrace.
When it was a real news story that had actually occurred. I mean, this was something that actually happened. This wasn't a bogus story. But the president-elect was telling the world that up was down and black was white. And during the press conference, I could tell he did not want to take my question. I would try to say, Mr. President, will you take a question? You're attacking us. And he said, I'm not going to do that. Your organization is terrible. And finally, I just decided to, you know, interject in the middle of that news conference and ask my question.
Can you give us a question?
Don't be.
And he shouted me down, called me fake news.
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
And I said that was not appropriate. I ended up getting the question out. Our friends at PBS Frontline has a video of me asking the question. And the question that I wanted to ask that day was, did any of your aides or associates have contacts with the Russians during the campaign? And as we found out later on, that was a legitimate question to be asked at the time.
Indeed. But you write that on that day, you made yourself part of the story, something that you've been criticized for a lot.
And it was something that I was trained not to do as a reporter coming up in this business. You're not supposed to be the story. And my intention that day was not to make myself the story. My intention that day was to get my question heard. And part of the reason why I wanted to interject at that moment was because the president was calling a real news story, an actual thing that had occurred, fake news. I thought that was something that we'd never heard before from an incoming president. And I thought that was wrong. And then I also was reflecting on what had happened during the campaign, Diane, and people forget about this. Then candidate Donald Trump called us the disgusting news media, the dishonest news media, liars, scum, and so on. And he would have thousands and thousands of people in an arena cheering him on as he did this. And I thought that was an unwelcome development during the campaign. And as we saw, he rolled that act right into the administration and has escalated that rhetoric ever since then, calling us fake news and the enemy of the people. That is just way outside the bounds of normal presidential behavior to have a president refer to the press or any segment of American society as the enemy of the people.
And talk about Kellyanne Conway's use of the term alternative facts, which she later said she regretted using. She was moving too quickly. She sort of joined two thoughts and created that phrase that's been quoted again and again.
Yes, and I thought that was an interesting moment. She sat down with me for a good hour for an on-the-record interview, and I said, Kellyanne, what about this alternative facts line that you gave? You know, this has been sort of a phrase that has been attached to the Trump administration, a defining term of the era. And she said, you know, I actually didn't mean to say that. And that took me by surprise. She said she meant to say alternative information and additional facts, and it got jumbled together. And as she told me, it was not meant to be an Orwellian phrase or to excuse lies. And I know there are folks out there who may not want to believe her, but I thought she was speaking with some regret about that, and that she feels badly that this has become this thing that I guess she can't really control how people use the term anymore, but it has become a defining term for this era, partly because, Diane, you know, this president, according to the Washington Post, has made approximately 10,000 false or misleading statements since coming into the presidency. That has made the job of journalists that much tougher because it's made us fact checkers in real time. And so we have to spend all of our time and energy fact checking the president and saying, wait a minute, yeah, that's not true. Wait a minute, this is only half true, and so on. That has angered the president, angered his team, angered a lot of his supporters. And I think that has also set the tone for what has happened over the last couple of years.
And indeed, I remember Scotty Nell Hughes coming onto my show.
That's right.
And saying, facts aren't really facts.
And I put that in the book. I put that in there because I thought that was an incredible moment, Diane.
You should have seen the jaws drop on the faces of the reporters in the studio that day. But here's the funny part. Shortly after Trump takes office, you have this interaction with Hope Hicks, the former White House communications director. What did she say to you, and what do you think she meant?
Well, this was the first full press conference he had of the new administration. It was February 16th, 2017, and he was taking questions about the Russia investigation. And remember, this was just right after Michael Flynn, the national security advisor, had been fired for lying to the vice president about his contacts with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. And Trump was jousting with reporters and going back and forth over all of that. And when he came to me, you know, I asked him a series of questions, and this was a lengthy exchange and went on for some time. And Trump, to, you know, jab at me a little bit, said, I'm not going to call you fake news anymore. I'm going to call you very fake news. And people in the room laughed, and it was a lighthearted moment, I suppose. But I did ask him, I said, you know, are you worried that using those kinds of terms undermines the American people's confidence in the free press in the United States? And he essentially conceded that that does happen to some extent. But after that lengthy exchange, after I left the press conference, I got a phone call, and it was Hope Hicks. And she goes, Jim, I just want you to know the president said that he thought you were very professional today. And he said, Jim gets it. And I thought to myself, Jim gets it. And, you know, what is this, an act? And I talked to a number of aides and advisors to Trump who said it is basically an act. And Diane, what I have experienced over the last couple of years is that the president's act of trolling us and taunting us has gotten out of control. It's gotten out of his control. And he's escalated it by calling us the enemy of the people and so on. And many of his supporters are wonderful people, but some of them have absorbed that rhetoric and directed that hostility at us in ways that make journalists feel endangered. And my goodness, Diane, you and I have been doing this for a while. We have never experienced something like that in this
country. Absolutely.
And we don't want to get to a point where a reporter is hurt or, God forbid, killed in this country. At that point, the United States of America changes, and it doesn't change for the better.
The title of your book, The Enemy of the People, was the phrase he used on November 7th, 2018. Tell us how that came about.
Well, it was not a good day for him. The Republicans had just lost the House in the midterm elections. They barely hung on to the Senate. And, you know, he came into that press conference ready to rumble. And he was getting into it with reporters before he ever got to me.
And so the follow-up.
You heard my answer. Go ahead.
And I thought it was important to challenge him on something that he had said in the days leading up to the midterms, that this caravan of migrants heading towards the border amounted to an invasion. It wasn't an invasion. I mean, there were a lot of people in that caravan, sure, but they weren't invading the United States. And I thought it was another example of the president using superheated rhetoric to demonize immigrants for political gain. And so I wanted to ask him about that. And we went back and forth, and eventually he got fed up.
If I may ask one other question, Mr. President, if I may ask one other question, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President,
Ben said my time was done, and an intern came in, took my microphone, but the president lashing out at me, you know, called me a rude and terrible person and eventually described me as the enemy of the people.
Well, when you report fake news, no, when you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people. Go ahead.
And later on that day, I lost my press pass. And, you know, we went through a pretty lengthy ordeal over that, getting it back. But, you know, to me, it was a moment to reflect on, because, you know, the folks at home need to think deeply about this. Do we want to have a country where the press or any segment of American society is referred to as the enemy of the people? To me, that's outside the bounds of what we've all experienced as being normal political behavior in this country.
And you have actually had some threats on your life as a result.
Yes. My social media accounts, that has been almost like an open sewer in some ways. And some folks come on there, people who describe themselves as Trump supporters, and say all sorts of horrible, threatening things and leave death threats and so on. And, you know, I've had to alert that to the authorities. I had a conversation with the FBI on a couple of different occasions before the midterm elections, because it had gotten to the point where the FBI had to be notified. You know, I had to go to Trump rallies before the midterms with four bodyguards around me. Reporters shouldn't need bodyguards to go cover a political rally. And that's why I think, you know, the president, his team, his people, they feel very passionately about what they're trying to do for the country. I don't take that away from them, but they must understand that this rhetoric is out of their control. They've lost control of it. You know, a Trump supporter in a white van covered in anti-media signage is sending a pipe bomb to CNN and other Democratic officials around the country. That's out of control. And they need to understand that. And the president needs to understand that he needs to get it under control.
I don't know about whether getting it under control is something that's going to happen in the next few months. Tell us a little about your background, Jim.
Well, my dad is a Cuban immigrant, came over to this country in 1962, 3 weeks before the Cuban Missile Crisis. I call him one of the original dreamers. He moved from Miami to Northern Virginia pretty shortly after he arrived in this country. He tells me the story about how a Presbyterian church in Northern Virginia, Vienna, Virginia, provided he and my grandmother with coats and sweaters so they could stay warm in their first winter in Washington, because it didn't snow down in Cuba.
Yeah.
And, you know, he experienced kindness when he came to this country. You know, of course, there was prejudice here and there, but the government wasn't referring to people as an infestation. The president of the United States at the time, John F. Kennedy, was not referring to immigrants as rapists and criminals and so on. And I like to remind folks of that, because we've had an immigrant experience in this country that has been immensely positive to the United States. And we see it across the board in all walks of life, immigrants coming to this country and making a positive contribution. And, you know, I had this confrontation with Stephen Miller about it, where Stephen Miller came into the briefing room to talk about immigration policy. We got into this debate over the Statue of Liberty. The Statue of Liberty says, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free." Doesn't say anything about speaking English or being able to be a computer programmer. And Stephen Miller, the domestic policy advisor to the president, says, "Well, the Statue of Liberty is not about immigration." And I said, "Wait a minute, that's national park revisionism. You know, it's right there on the Statue of Liberty website. It says the immigrant statue."
How did he respond when you said that?
Well, we went back and forth for several minutes.
I don't want to get off into a whole thing about history here, but the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of liberty enlightening the world. It's a symbol of American liberty lighting the world.
And he accused me of having a cosmopolitan bias, for whatever that means. You know, I grew up, not only was my dad a blue-collar worker, my mom worked in restaurants, raised me as a single mom from the age of five after my parents got divorced. I'm hardly cosmopolitan.
When we come back, more with CNN's Jim Acosta about his experiences covering Donald Trump.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Jim Acosta. You know, you say in the book that a major turning point for you in covering this presidency was what happened in Charlottesville. Talk about that.
Well, what we saw with Charlottesville, and it really cuts to the core of what I write about in this book. I don't think there are two sides to the story when it's a matter of right versus wrong. And when the president of the United States faces, you know, the ugliness of what we saw down in Charlottesville, he's got to get it right the first time. And the president equivocated. There's just no other way to put it. He equivocated over white supremacist and neo-Nazi violence in an American city.
I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either.
And he had to go back and forth and say it several different ways. And, you know, Trump supporters and so on will say, well, what are you talking about? He finally condemned them. Yeah, it took several tries, but he did. But there was one press conference at Trump Tower where we went back and forth. And I said, Mr. President, the neo-Nazis caused this violence down there. And that's when he said that there were very fine people on both sides. And I chimed in and I said, well, there aren't any fine people in the Nazis. And, you know, to me, I didn't feel it was necessary to phrase those comments in the form of a question because there isn't a question there. It's not up to debate as to how Nazis should be viewed in this country. They're bad people. They're not fine people. And to me, that was a point where it just became clear to me that we have a president of the United States who is from time to time going to say things that are just outside the bounds of what we consider to be normal presidential behavior. And as reporters, we have a choice. Do you just say, well, on one side, the president said this about the Nazis, and on the other side, he said this? I mean, to me, there's only one thing to report, and that is the president let everybody down.
It's interesting that more and more news media are now calling out lies as lies. What do you think it took to finally get them to that point of using the word lie?
Well, and Diane, you and I are uncomfortable with that. I'm not comfortable with it. But it's gotten to a point, and it goes back to the conversation that you had with Scotty Nell Hughes and what Trump supporters have said to me. I had one advisor say to me one time, well, the truth is a moving target. The truth is not a moving target. The truth is the truth. And I think I don't know if it was one particular thing that has led the media to make this decision, well, we're just going to say lies are lies. I think it's been a slow evolution. And one of the things that we've been going through in this country, Diane, and I'm sure you've picked up on this too, is we've all been grappling with exactly how to cover this president. This has been an enormously difficult challenge and question for people in our industry because we are banging up against decades of tradition of holding the presidency in high esteem and saying, you know, we can't go call the president a liar. We can't say that he's lying. That's just way outside our lane. But if the president is going to consistently on a regular basis, you know, according to the Washington Post fact checker, utter 10,000 false or misleading things over the course of 2 years in the administration, my goodness, can you imagine, Diane, if we had spent the last 2 years not correcting the record? What would be our sense of the truth and reality anymore?
I want to go back for a moment to the issue of immigration and what Mr. Trump has said about those people coming across the border and the separation of children from their families and what the press found out as a reality.
The separation of children from their parents at the border, in my view, is just going to go down as one of the most regrettable things this country has done in recent history. One of the more interesting things I found as I was writing this is going back to Kellyanne Conway when we sat down for this interview is she said to me that it was contrary to her Catholic beliefs that we would separate children from their parents. And she is one of the most senior advisors to the president. So if you have somebody on the record, a senior advisor to the president, saying, well, this violates my beliefs as a Catholic to separate children from their parents, it just goes to show you this was a highly controversial policy inside the administration. And there must be people more than just Kellyanne. Ivanka Trump said it was a low point for the administration. There must be people who are just holding their heads in their hands and thinking, I can't believe we did this. And to this day, we don't have a full accounting of all of these kids, and there may well be orphans as a result of this policy. And I don't know how we account for that as a country. There has to be a reckoning, I think, in this country, and we're starting to see hearings and so on up on Capitol Hill about this. But to me, it's just, I think we sometimes don't feel it in the moment. It takes 5 years, 10 years from now. And then we look back on some of these things and we say, oh, gosh.
When you think about the agreement, so-called, that's just been reached with Mexico, that the Washington Post reported and the New York Times reported had been agreed to 6 months ago, You wonder why we had to be led to the brink of some catastrophe And then told, oh, well, we're fine now.
It reminds me of what happened with Kim Jong-un in North Korea. Remember, there was all of this rhetoric going back and forth, you know, little rocket man and so on. The president was referring to Kim Jong-un in all sorts of ways. And the rhetoric was escalating. And then they had this summit in Singapore where the president says, we've got a deal. He's going to give up his nuclear weapons. We've got a deal. Here we are, a year and some time after that agreement, and we don't have a deal. And North Korea has not given up its nuclear arsenal. As a matter of fact, there was another summit in Vietnam where they seemed to backslide in terms of their understanding as to what they should be doing. And so this is a pattern that we've seen with this president where he engages in brinkmanship. He attempts to solve the problem and then claims afterwards he's struck a deal and victory has been had. We've won and so on. And then you get into the details and you find out, well, maybe not. That may not be the case. I think we're seeing that again with these tariffs, in that he took things to the brink, pulled back, and is claiming victory. And we're just going to have to wait. And this is where it's so important for reporters to be able to do their jobs. We have to be able to get into these details and find out exactly what did you guys agree to after all, or is this just talk?
You know, I do want to ask you about press briefings, How they are not occurring these days. And even when they are, they're out behind a barrier of some sort, a parking barrier.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is that like for you?
Well, it ain't what it used to be, that's for sure. You and I are talking about 90 or so days since the last White House briefing in the briefing room. The briefing room is now a cafeteria. It's where people sit down and eat their lunch inside the White House, the press corps. What we see instead in its place is Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, or Kellyanne Conway will go out and talk and typically do an exclusive interview with Fox News that lasts 10 or 15 minutes. And then they walk back to the White House and all the press is gathered in the driveway, hoping that they'll stop and talk to us for a few minutes and answer our questions. And it is not the same as having a White House briefing that goes on for 30 minutes to an hour, where a variety of reporters from various different outlets ask questions. And it does do a disservice, I think, to the American people, because, you know, you have situations like, for example, the helicopter that hit a building in Manhattan. There are questions that need to be asked. Do we get all the information that we want at that particular moment during a White House briefing? No, but you remember, Diane, during the Obama administration, Josh Earnest or Jake Carney would have a press briefing, and those kinds of news of the day questions would get an airing. And then more complicated questions would be asked about fiscal policy, about health care, foreign policy, and national security matters. There's a wide range of topics that are covered. And this administration has just totally gotten away from that kind of accountability. And what we've seen in its place is in addition to those driveway briefings, the president likes to be his own press secretary and his own communications director. And so on occasion, he'll take questions from us in the Oval Office or out on the South Lawn as he's leaving. But notice something interesting. When he doesn't want to take our questions, he doesn't take our questions. Yeah. They yell at us and we have to get out of the room. We're out on the South Lawn of the White House. He'll take our questions, but you can't hear him because the helicopter is going in the background. And so the playing field has been tilted heavily in their favor with this adjustment that they've made to the briefings.
Do you, as well as many of your colleagues, carry some amount of responsibility for the fact that Donald Trump is the president of the United States?
You know, that question has been asked, and I don't subscribe to that view. I'll say I know that folks get upset from time to time and they say, you guys covered the rallies too much during the 2016 campaign and so on. Well, there were a lot of news outlets that were covering those rallies, and there were a lot of news outlets that had on their main pages lots of different stories about Donald Trump. He was driving a lot of the coverage back then. One of the reasons, and we weren't aware of this at the time, that he threw all of this red meat out there and used so much volatile rhetoric is they saw behind the scenes inside the Trump campaign is that it drove the news coverage and it kept him in the front of the pack. And I think this time around we're going to see that that kind of coverage has to be tweaked. It has to be changed.
How do you change that? What do you do? What do you do to change that?
You're going to see these rallies not covered live end-to-end quite as much as we saw during the 2016 campaign. I think you're going to see a fact-checker standing by, not just the reporter at the campaign rally, but a fact-checker standing by to say, wait a minute, the president got this wrong here. He didn't say that right there. And not just Donald Trump, on the Democratic side as well. And so that is one of the ways that I think, Diane, you're going to see the coverage change a little bit, become a little more sophisticated. And in terms of responsibility, I mean, let's just also make it very clear. Yeah, I would be remiss if I didn't say this. You know, we were not the ones that said, you know, don't campaign in Wisconsin, don't campaign in some of these states. Hillary Clinton was on the ballot in 2016. You know, the press was not. And, you know, I think we're all a little bit more savvy now heading into 2020. And I think it's been a good experience for the press. I think we've been through a lot, but I think we have a better appreciation of this line of work and the importance that it has in American society moving forward.
Are you going to get out on the campaign trail following the president?
Well, I think I'll be out there somewhat. As I tell folks, I want to see how this movie ends. And so I suppose I'll be out there.
But how much danger do you feel you're actually in?
We do take precautions for that. And, you know, we'll assess that as it comes. One of the things that I've been most grateful for is the support that I've had over here at CNN. They know that it has not been easy going through what we've all been going through over here. They stood up for me when my press pass was taken away. They've had my back ever since. And I think heading into 2020, you're going to see all of us, not just at CNN, but across the White House press corps and the National Press Corps, I think we're going to be a little more aware of some of the tricks the president's, magicians had of media manipulation, and perhaps a bit more savvy in terms of how to cover them. And so it may not be necessary to always be at the rallies to cover them. There are lots of other different ways to cover this president, and I suspect we'll be exploring that in the days ahead.
I have one last question for you, considering everything that's happened in the past few years. How does your family feel about the work you're doing?
Well, my dad is, he's as proud as a Cuban dad can be. My mom, she is a Washingtonian. She was born in Washington, D.C. Her parents are buried at Arlington National Cemetery. She gets the Washington Post on her doorstep every day. Both my folks tell me to keep doing what I'm doing. Obviously, everybody's aware of the risks and the things that are going on out there. But I find this just to be an incredibly important period in our history, Diane. I'm immensely grateful to be a part of it. And I think this is not a time to back down as journalists. This is a time to reflect on the role that we have in American society. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book is I want the reader to have a better appreciation for what we do. We're not the enemy of the people. We are defenders of the people. And as long as we keep all of that in the forefront, we're going to be just fine heading into the days ahead.
Jim Acosta, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate it.
That's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Look for past podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianereem.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urd-Lipker. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you on Tuesday. I'm Diane Rehm.